You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
I want to be a producer with a hit show on Broadway. I want to be a producer.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
Hello, Producers Perspective podcast listeners. We are back. I'm going to tell you a little dirty secret of the podcasting business is that these podcasts are recorded sometimes well in advance of the day I release them. I know you are all shocked. And this podcast with my very special guest, who I'll introduce in a second, is being recorded just a few days after one of the biggest entertainment events of the year, the Academy Awards, awards, which is very fitting for my guest today because he's actually an Academy Award nominated filmmaker. His name is Richard LeGravenaise. Welcome, Richard.
Thank you, Ken. Pleasure.
Richard is a screenwriter and a film director. He was nominated for an Oscar for the screenplay to The Fisher King, which is one of my favorite movies.
Thanks.
And I know someone that wants to make it into a musical, I think. So, but we'll get to that. Also written the screenplays to some other little-known films like, oh, I don't know, Bridges in Madison County, which was a musical, Water for Elephants, which I hear they're making into a musical.
Oh, they are?
He doesn't even know. Beautiful Creatures, which he also directed. And most recently, he was the director and screenwriter and champion with a capital C for the film The Last 5 Years, the Jason Robert Brown musical starring Jeremy Jordan and Anna Kendrick. Now, you all know why he's here. Here is a Hollywood power writer that is building the bridge to Broadway. But what I, and that's what I love about him, that's where I really wanted you to hear from him and his very unique perspective on both sides of the nation. So, Richard, tell me, you're from Brooklyn, New York, true?
Yes, I am.
You went to the Tisch School of the Arts.
Yep, for the experimental theater wing.
My alma mater, Tisch as well.
Yeah.
So how did this acting major from Brooklyn, New York, end up on the other side of the country writing screenplays?
Because okay.
I assume theater was a big thing.
Well, first let me say, I've never lived on the other side of the country. So I've never lived in Los Angeles. So I don't know why everyone in New York thinks I'm a Hollywood screenwriter, but I guess because that's where the business is and that's where the movies are made. But no, I consider myself a New Yorker. I've lived here all my life. And what happened was I was a theater actor slash writer, and I was part of a comedy act. I had done experimental theater. I was a chorus boy in summer stock. I did all that kind of stuff. And I wrote a one-act play for my partner and I, a comedy act I had that we did at The Lion on 42nd Street. And it happened to be the first date I asked my soon-to-be wife on. And when she saw it, she says, "Wow, you're a really incredible writer." And I went, "Oh, really? I don't know." And because I really want to be an actor and blah, blah, blah. And she says, no, you really should stick with the writing. And then, you know, long time we dated and then ultimately married. And I got a job assisting to a screenwriter, a wonderful writer named Neil Levy, who had sold an idea, a movie idea. And I knew nothing about film. Except that I loved it. I was obsessive about movies. But I didn't know how to write them. So I sort of apprenticed him, and that movie took about 3 years to get made, and in the process, it was very frustrating, not working with him, but working with this real kind of nightmare of a producer named Aaron Russo, who used to be Bette Midler's manager, and I think the Rose was sort of based on him and her. Anyway, during that period, I had just gotten married. I wanted my life to start. I was frustrated, so I was going to write a screenplay on spec, which means for free, that I would then hand out to try and get a job. And this was on the encouragement of my wife, who was supporting us at the time. And that screenplay turned out to be The Fisher King. And when I sold it in August, September of 1988, I've been working ever since. So I didn't have to move out there because they knew where I was, and when they need me, they fly me out there. That screenplay got everything started.
And you had never written a screenplay before?
Not by myself. That was the first screenplay I had written on my own. The other screenplay, I sort of apprenticed, and Neil Levy taught me how to write a screenplay. But he hired me because he loved my knack for dialogue, because he had seen my comedy act, and I wrote skit comedy, so it was all based on dialogue.
So, starting out as a playwright and then becoming a screenwriter, tell me a little bit about the differences, if there are any, between writing and tackling the two.
I'm still learning. I'm still learning because, my tendency is to write dialogue. I love actors. I love watching actors give great performances. It's why part of the reason I love movies. Learning the language of cinema, the language of a camera is something that I'm still learning, but I've had some great masters to learn from. So I consider myself in my DNA primarily a writer, writing for film. This movie, Last 5 Years, was for me at this stage of the game one of the first times I felt as a director that I designed a movie, and that the screenplay, because it was Jason's material, the screenplay was primarily how I was going to shoot it and how I was going to tie things together and what the production would look like and how their costumes would tell time and what their backstories would be, because I had both characters singing to each other. And it was really a challenge and an opportunity for me to write in the language of camera. Because I didn't have to write dialogue except for little bits here and there. This was all, Jason's material. And I had more confidence in his material than I've ever had in my own. So it was easy.
Oh, that's hysterical. You've talked about you've worked with some masters mm-hmm. of the form. Certainly you've worked with some incredible directors.
Yes, yes. Well, the last, I wrote Behind the Candelabra, and that was Soderbergh. And Soderbergh's been a tremendous influence, and Terry Gilliam, and Robert Redford was a wonderful director. Francis Lawrence. I've had a lot of great Clint Eastwood, who I've worked very briefly with, but even in that brief time, I learned quite a bit. I've been lucky.
And being a director, we talk about the difference between a writer for screenplays and for theater. What about directing for the stage versus directing for film? Obviously, the camera involved, but how involved are... I remember talking to Sam Mendes about, when he was doing Gypsy, about mm-hmm. American Beauty, and hearing so much the director and the technical aspect of the film and the camera mm-hmm. versus how much time they get to spend with the actors. Mm-hmm. What kind of director are you?
I love working with actors. That's my favorite part. This movie, Last 5 Years, I got to do both because it was such a small production, and I had the best relationship I ever had with a cinematographer called Steven Meisler. And so we were a real partnership, and so I got to be on the technical side of it. I felt much more comfortable and had more fun than I ever had before. But working with the actors is my favorite part. In film directing, there's an old adage that says 80% of movie directing is casting. So you do a lot of that work in the casting, and then you sort of step out of the way. And then when they need any kind of guidance, or there are questions, or new things come up and new ideas, I encourage collaboration. I love when actors are excited and want to create something with me. And they both came up with wonderful ideas. I always wait until I get the take that I know I wanted, a click I feel. And then after that, I go up to the actor and say, I have it. Now I want you to do it for yourself. Just throw everything away and do whatever you want. And I'll keep the camera rolling until, you know, you want to say stop. Because I like them to have their own click as well. And oftentimes those takes are wonderful, a little more spontaneous. You don't see all the homework, you know. But I love working with actors. I respect them.
I wonder what a theater director would say the percentage of their work is casting versus a film is 80%. I haven't had a director on the podcast yet, so I'll have to ask the same question.
They say that John Huston said that about film because, you know, as a director, you're dealing with so many technical aspects that the thing about film in the beginning I didn't like is that the human element, which are the actors and the performances, are rushed and because the lighting and the technical aspect, that's what you wait around for. That's where all the camera and the angles and all the time gets sucked up by that. So when the actors have to come to do their thing, sometimes, not often, but sometimes they're not given their due. They have to rush through, you know, and I hate that. So I try and balance it out so that the actors are taken care of and can give, you know, good performances.
And let's talk about producers in Hollywood versus producers on Broadway. Certainly you've known both, you've worked with both.
I've never really worked with New York producers. I mean theater producers. I know them as friends, but I've never worked with them. So I don't know that I can compare.
And what's the relationship like in Hollywood with a producer? How are they as hands-on as they as?
There are all kinds of producers. That's the thing. It's an interesting term. Some producers are great in development creatively. Some producers are great at playing the sort of three-card Monty game of how to get a movie through a system and dealing with studios. Some producers come up with ideas and buy books and then hire writers, and they have their own vision about what they want to do. Some producers find original material and then just encourage you to, you know, they believe in you. They're all different kinds, you know. And then there's some who just raise money and some who just manage the money. Producers are a wide term.
So let's talk about the last 5 years specifically. What drew you to it? Or when did you first see it or hear about it?
I never saw the original production. My friend, Todd Graff, who wrote and directed a movie called Camp about Stage Door Manor, is a good friend. And I would say about 2004, 2005, he gave me the soundtrack because I kept hearing about it and I didn't know it. And I just fell in love with the score. I love the score. It's so honest and insightful and rich and heartbreaking and funny. And it became one of my top 10 favorite scores. And I just would listen to it over and over and over in between doing work, in between writing. And it became sort of a reward for me to sort of fantasize about making this into a little movie outside of the system. And slowly but surely, step by step, it became a reality.
And did you know Jason? What was that first meeting like when you said, I want to make this into a movie?
Well, it all started with, I was auditioning, I was holding auditions for a film in 2006, I believe. And Sherry Renee Scott came in, and the first thing I said, I just gushed over her about last 5 years, and said to her, I've always had this little fantasy about making a little movie. And so she introduced me to her then-husband, Kurt Deutsch. They have a company called Shikaboom Records. And Kurt had a similar idea. I did not know that, but he had an idea. And I said, I'd like to do this. And then he introduced me to Jason. And for a few years there, it was just the three of us. And Jason and I never believed it was actually going to happen. And Jason was living in L.A. at the time. So anytime I went out to L.A. for work, I would always sit up at lunch or something with him. And we'd just have fun. We would just talk about the script. I'd write it, you know, in my spare time and come up with ideas. And then he'd, you know, say yes to this, no to that, try that. That's something different. He was wonderful to work with. He was just one of the funniest, smartest men. And this went on for a few years. And Kurt's determination to, you know, make it happen, you know, he kept on me no matter what else I was focused on. And it started to become a reality. And then a friend of mine, Janet Brenner, who's a producer, born in theater, and now in film, I brought her in to help, and she brought in Lauren Versal, who is an independent film producer who knows how that system works, because I had never done independent film before. And the three of them became my producing team, and they raised the money. And somewhere along the way, before Pitch Perfect came out, Anna Kendrick, I met with Anna, who was my first choice, and she attached herself to the movie, which was lucky, because Pitch Perfect hadn't come out yet. I wanted her because she's Anna Kendrick, and because I loved camp, I just thought she was perfect. And she loved, her favorite musical is Parade. So she knew Jason from Parade, and one thing led to another, and she read the script and heard the score, and thankfully attached herself to it, and we were able to raise money.
What was the budget?
I don't know if I'm allowed to say. It's in the low, low, low single digits.
Yeah, amazing. That's what I was actually asked to invest in the original off-Broadway production of the last 5 years, which I passed on. And the funny thing is, I've known Jason for a year. Quick story is that he was my vocal coach when I was in college at Tisch.
No, really?
The story goes that I was literally my second day of class singing Why God Why from Miss Saigon. And I heard something from the accompaniment that I'd never heard before, an improvised something. And I was singing, and I turned and looked and saw this moppy-haired kid banging away at the piano. And I remember that was – I can think back and go, that was the first time I ever heard genius coming from a person.
Yeah.
And I approached him after class, and I said, I would love to do something with you. And he was my vocal coach for a number of years.
That's
so,
really cool.
Yeah, I was involved very, very early on with a lot of his stuff. So certainly I could see why the score would attract you.
We just saw Parade the other night at Avery Fisher. It was unbelievable. Unbelievable.
I was the company manager for the workshop of that when it went to Toronto. And being around, it was just amazing. But in the score, his music, there's something that gets you so inside your heart.
Mm-hmm.
But when I look to take a book or a movie and turn it into the theater, one of the questions we have to ask ourselves is, why the theater? What about this art form is a great way to tell this story? So here's something that was a very personal story to Jason, and done in a very theatrical way to people telling their story.
In monologues to the audience, not to each other.
And
in
reverse
time zones, right.
So you looked at this and heard this, and obviously we're attracted to the score, but what was it about? I have a different way that can only be done on film. What was the
Well, because I hadn't seen it on stage, I listened to the score, and my imagination went into seeing the songs as playable scenes, as them singing to each other when that was essay. That's just how my imagination went. Then I found out that it was a monologue piece. And then years later, I started the Pasadena Playhouse for the first time. And I just couldn't help seeing it and being able to make it work. Look, I wasn't 100% sure, and I know there are many people out there that for whom it doesn't work. But I wanted to see something I hadn't seen on film before. I'm at a point, and was at a point in my career where you just get so tired. I got tired of worrying about box office and trying to please everybody and trying to write something that appeals to a mass general public and not feeling like you're doing anything that you really love and that you really care about. And, that's more personal. And even though I did not write this, this is a very personal material to me. I relate to it a great deal. And, Jason has that power with his work. And so I wanted to do it for me. And, creatively, it's just something that I needed to feed myself. And I knew, that my theater tribe, my musical theater tribe, cause my daughter is also a musical theater nut, and I know a lot of her, that generation through her, that they'd be interested. So if I could do this on a very, very small budget, I shot it in 21 days, that it would be a responsible, personal project. You know, I wouldn't be, wasting a lot of money, but I would do it the way I wanted to do it, without interference. I wanted to keep it in Jason's form. I didn't want to impose a screenplay on it, because I felt that if we did it through a Hollywood studio, that's what they would have asked for. And it was the best time I ever had creatively, and I needed it. I needed to do that, something that I hadn't seen before. It was a risk, and I needed to take it.
Since the Chicago Revolution, we've seen a number of...
Was Chicago a revolution? I've read that before. Was that because it was so successful?
Because it was so successful and because all of a sudden we thought, oh, it can be done again.
It can be done, yes, I see.
Because we all knew here in the industry there were tons of musicals that were made into movies in the golden age, and then it just stopped.
It just stopped, like, yeah.
Hollywood hated us for a while. We can't touch musicals. I kind of think of the way American Idol says, you sound too Broadway. I feel like Hollywood had that appeal.
Because it came the other way. Suddenly, when Lion King came here, suddenly Hollywood was realizing that their properties could be turned into stage productions, so I know it was going that way.
Right.
But I guess Chicago, I mean, I love Chicago. I saw the original also. And I love Bill Condon's work and Rob Marshall. But I didn't realize that that was kind of a watershed, because I guess it was.
Yeah, we've seen obviously a number since then, some very, very good and some not so good.
Yeah.
Did you study all those as you were?
No, I mean, I watched them just because I love musicals. I mean, you know, Osmosis as a kid, I mean, I've watched every musical that's ever been made. So, you know, things will come out that I don't even mean to come out. I mean, when Jeremy is singing, you know, Moving Too Fast, he's on a water taxi, I'm going, oh, it's Funny Girl. And I didn't even mean that to happen. It just kind of happened because we had to change. You know, I originally had him on a bicycle going across the Brooklyn Bridge, but we couldn't afford a helicopter. So I had to change it. So it's just in my blood, seeing every musical, you know, over and over and over.
And do you think and have a desire to do more?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah?
Yeah, absolutely.
What's
Well, the last thing I just did, I rewrote. Julian Fellowes did the first draft, and he's a brilliant writer from Downton Abbey. I just rewrote the Gypsy for Streisand, and that was a ball. That was such a great... That was like a dream come true, working with her on that musical. You know, it just was fantastic. And I hope that that gets made. They're looking for a director on it, because that would be, her singing that score would be historic. But it was such a great time. And also, you know, working with Arthur Lawrence's book, it was just, it's such a great book. He did, you know, you have to go back to it. You have to use that as your core in that. You can't stray too far from that. So that was that. I'm doing a musical, I'm writing one for the stage that I'm, almost finished with the first draft on. And that Casey Nicolau and I are excited about. So I'm getting closer and closer to doing theater. More film musicals? Yeah, sure. There'd have to be something cool that I wanted to do. But, you know, I'm a little worried about working in a studio system where having this independence and doing it meant a lot. I wonder if it could work the other way. I don't know. For me, personally, only me personally.
Now, so you're starting to get more into theater and writing more theater, and you have a daughter, and she's a musical theater nut.
Mm-hmm.
If your daughter came to you and said one day, Dad, I have a choice. I could have a successful career in Hollywood or a successful career on Broadway. Which one would you want her to choose?
Oh, boy. You know, I wouldn't presume to tell her. It really is, you got to follow where your heart goes. Boy, that sounds so corny. It's not just where your heart goes, but where your personality goes, because you need a certain kind of skin for both, you know. You know, I was just in San Francisco, and I was interviewed by the guy who runs ACT out there, and there's a great group of actors out there, really fine actors, who chose to stay in San Francisco and not make the move to New York, and they work all the time, and because they love the work. You know, there is a life to be had as an actor or an actress, where you can work steady and not necessarily, you know, win an Oscar or become a famous person, but you can have a wonderful life if you love the work. You have to love the work. You can't want it for any other reason. Success is a byproduct, you know.
Such great advice. I tell people that all the time.
But it's really true.
Yeah, you want to be an actor? You can be an actor anywhere. Being a Broadway actor doesn't just mean you're
an actor. You can be an actor anyway. Tennessee Williams had a great quote that I'm not going to say right, but it was something along the lines of, success is like a shy mouse. If you stare at it, it won't come out. You know, you have to not pay attention to it, you know, for it to come out.
And when you were obviously growing up in New York, you saw a lot of Broadway shows, obviously.
Well, I was big. The first thing was movies. I was a movie nut when I was a kid, mostly. And then when I was 12, my parents took me to see Follies. That was my first Broadway musical. And I flipped out. I remember having to explain the second act to my mother. No, he didn't forget the lyrics. He's having a nervous breakdown. Oh, okay, I understand now. And then I used to sneak into the city to see plays and to walk up and down the theater district. In those days, when you're 13, 14, you hop on the train and you know, could do all of that. So New York, for me, was always the dream. Hollywood was never – I never had any desire for Hollywood. This – being in New York was – getting across the river was my dream. So, yeah, theater is – it was – I don't know. Movies just seemed so impossible for a kid from Brooklyn whose father's a cab driver, knows nobody. How does that work? So I – but theater felt real. And I remember being at ETW working with Ann Bogart and a group of us outcasts and feeling – I never felt more creative in my life. That was the first time I experienced what it was like to be creative, and it was such a high.
And how do you think, obviously, since you've lived here and you've seen Broadway, even though you haven't been working on it for the past couple decades, how has it changed, or how do you think it's changed?
Well, I don't think I'm saying anything new. It's gotten a little more top-heavy in terms of needing names and stars, to attract. I wish there was a more of an off-Broadway. When I was a kid, you know, there were plays that were playwrights were allowed to sort of have their failures and to have their medium-sized hits so that they can have their bigger. Now you sort of have to come out of the gate, having a masterpiece, or you fail, and that's the sad thing about New York. And you have to go to regional theater, I guess, to develop your talent and your skills a bit more, because here it's so the stakes are so high, the money is so, the rentals and all that stuff, so it's constricted it a little bit in terms of the kinds of talent that we can draw here to bring new kind of material. There's nothing wrong with having name actors, as long as they're good actors, to come and do stuff. But there's New York. Sidney Lumet once said to me, one of the reasons he always shot in New York is because the wealth of talent here is just constant. There's always new, always coming out. And I'm proud of the New York actor scene. There's really amazing actors here.
So if there was a son of a cab driver listening to this podcast right now that said he wanted to be a writer someday on Broadway or in Hollywood, what kind of advice would you have?
Right. You have to. I think what happened for me was, it was that thing of work preparation meeting opportunity. I worked on a screenplay on and off for like 2 years, and the writer's strike happened, and I couldn't sell it. And when the writer's strike was over, suddenly everybody was reading scripts, and the scripts they were reading were surprisingly more for the marketplace. And this original script kind of caught their eye because it was something they hadn't expected. Today, I would have never been able to pitch or sell that script. It was just about timing, I think.
Where did that idea come from?
It was the 80s, which for me was a really ugly decade. for many reasons, especially the early part, the early half of the 80s was really tough. And I found the time that we were living in, I just felt it was a real narcissistic, cruel, there was a cruelty in the air and a real narcissism. And I wanted to write something about that. So all I had was the idea of a narcissistic man who by the end of the story does a selfless act. And that really was the whole spine of it. And then it just took me about 3 or 4 drafts with completely different stories to find out how to tell it.
And do you think it'd make a good musical?
Well, I have worked with a couple of people who wanted to. I hesitate because one of the reasons I think that it's so great is because Terry Gilliam directed it. And he directed it away from sentimentality. And the problem with putting music to that, or a certain kind of music, is that it could make the story could easily slip into being very corny and sentimental. So it would take a really specific composer-lyricist team. Yeah.
You are now writing for the theater. Do you think you will direct for the theater?
I would love to direct for the theater as well. Yeah, absolutely.
Your own work? Will you do your own work?
I would love to do someone else's or I'm looking right now. I'm looking for revivals, but of plays that aren't usually done. I get the feeling, you know, they always revive the same plays. You know, it's like The Heiress and Carnation Roof and, you know, and really, and there's got to be other stuff out there. And there's got to be... there's got to be gold out there that hasn't been mined, and that's what I'm looking for. And if you've read John Lahr's book, the Tennessee Williams bio, is unbelievable. It's one of the greatest books I ever read about a writer. And there's about 20 years of Tennessee Williams plays that were, you know, completely trashed by writers, by critics, for many reasons. But you never know. There might be one thing in there that could be revived, that the time is now. I mean, I'm even going back to the 30s. I just want to do something... I don't want to direct my own play. I would like to have a great director to learn from, and I think you need an editor and you need an outsider. But I would love to direct a play that's already written.
It's interesting. I think in film, it's more common to see a writer-director combo. You do that a lot.
Now, ever since the mid-90s, yeah, that's been the scene. But I didn't start that way. I really just loved being a writer. I never had any intention of directing. It became a necessity after a while because we're at the bottom of the food chain, now more than ever. And we have no power. If you write an original and the studio buys it, they own the copyright. They could do anything they want with it. If you do an adaptation, they can do anything they want with it, hire any director, rewrite the script, as they do often. So you have no control. So, and they don't really respect you as much as they do a director, because a director, when they say yes, a movie can happen. A writer just creates the thing. And then, of course, you know, everybody's second job is writing, so everybody gives you notes from everybody, can tell you. No one tells producers or executives how to be executives, but they feel the need to tell us how to write. So it's a whole hierarchy that's difficult. It's just difficult.
It's a massive difference in how the two industries treat their writers.
Massive, yeah. In theater, the writer is and in television... is more the lead, is more in control of their work. I don't know why Hollywood, the film industry, doesn't respect us to do our job correctly, or they don't trust us. I don't know why. If we've proven ourselves, even after so many years, they still insist on telling us how to do what we do.
So I'm sure there's been at least one point in your career where you sat back in a dark screening room and watched one of your films and been like, that is not what I wanted up there.
Oh, yeah.
How does that feel?
It's a heartbreaker. For me, personally, it breaks my heart because I really fall in love with what I'm working on. And I've done mostly adaptations for Hollywood. And I only pick them because I fall in love with the material and I have some personal connection to them. So it hurts. It hurts.
Is there a specific example of one that really disappointed you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. More than one.
We'll leave it at that. And what do you have a favorite of all the properties you've worked on today?
Behind the Candelabra, I'm very, very proud of that one. And I love the way it turned out. And Matt and Michael, they weren't just fantastic actors who did an incredible job. But for the 4 years that we were trying to set up the script, because I wrote it in 2008 for Stephen, and no studio wanted it because they said it was too gay. All those years, Michael and Matt would publicly say that they were doing the movie. And, that kind of, loyalty, they're just wonderful, wonderful guys.
It's confidence and strength like that from actors that,
oh my God, you never get that kind of thing. Oh, absolutely.
The world.
Oh, yeah.
Which that movie was helping to do. So,
yeah.
Okay, one last question. I want you to imagine that you're granted one wish. Your fairy godmother comes down and says, I'm going to give you one wish.
Oh, it's dangerous.
Yes, just one, though. And you can change just one thing about Broadway or Hollywood. I'll give you both. I only give everyone else Broadway. But since you work on both sides. You can change one thing, something that keeps you up at night, that frustrates you, whatever it is. Now, you can also think about this in terms of as a theater goer, because you see lots of shows here. Mm-hmm. But you can only change one, and with the snap of a finger, that fairy godmother will change it overnight. What would that one thing be?
Crap. create a viable off-Broadway community where there are theaters, where playwrights can do their work and there's a way to be profitable, where rents are easy to manage, where we can maybe have a company. You know, New York would be great if we had a theater company here in one of them. Just a way to broaden our theatrical spectrum away from the big budget blockbusters and star driven stuff that Broadway has, which is wonderful, but it's limiting. And it'd be great to have an off Broadway community again. I remember being a kid and even a teenager and looking at the ABCs, and sometimes the off Broadway ABCs were larger than the Broadway ones, and it's gone. And I don't understand why. People try to explain it to me because you can't make money off Broadway and the rents and the thing and the that. But I don't understand with this city and the theater lovers that we have here why we can't. You know, there's the Atlantic and there are some places. I love St. Anne's Warehouse. We need more places like that to me.
If this podcast were taped in front of a live studio audience, they just would have gone nuts at idea. Because I think everyone knows that what the real art of the theater that's missing is the viable off-Broadway community.
And I think New York, of all the cities, we really should make an effort to try and make that happen.
Yeah, because I get afraid that there are a lot of kids of taxi drivers mm-hmm. out there that want to write for the theater, mm-hmm. that are great writers,
yeah.
that get sucked up by Hollywood because there's nowhere here for them to write.
Yeah, and a lot of them and us are going to TV, which is great, has become a great medium, but there's nothing like the theater.
And that's why we're very thankful you're coming home to us and also building this bridge. Thank you so much for being here. Everyone out there, go see The Last 5 Years. Remember, supporting movie musicals means more of them, which is great for everyone. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast at theproducersperspective.com. We got some great guests coming up. Thank you again, Richard.
Thank you, Ken.
We'll see you all next time.
I'm gonna be a producer. Look out, Broadway.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but
yeah.
Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.